This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Hey listeners, this is Brent Sutton. Welcome to Season 4 and the 101st episode of the Practice of Learning Teams podcast show. On today's podcast, we continue the series called Hop Into Action. I'm joined by Jeffrey Lith, Brent Sutton, Josh Bryant and Diane R. Chan as a group of HOP and Learning Teams practitioners looking to make sense of putting HOP, Learning Teams and the 4Ds into action for organisations to learn and improve. Think of the series as a mini learning team. We have a theme for each episode, and we allow it to evolve or devolve organically. Today we explore some of the frontline insights from the workers with the 4Ds, the notion of curiosity versus criticism, and when your faith is challenged, and blame fixes nothing. So please sit back and enjoy the series of Hop Into Action, sponsored by Safety Differently Merch, providers of curated merchandise befitting your Safety Differently journey.
You know what I like about Sutton?
Nothing. Same as me. We've got similar interests.
Yeah.
We don't like anything about him.
I flew all this way for this level of abuse.
Usually it's over Zoom. All right, rock and roll.
So guys, welcome back. And here we go again. And once again, I thought it'd be a great experience for us today to share our experiences, either in the field or what we've been told by other organizations about our recent 4D experiences as we carry on this journey of learning and improving. And just for the audience, as we record this, Diane is still based in Auckland, New Zealand. Jeff is in Vancouver, British Columbia. And Josh Bryant, myself and Brent Robinson, we're actually in a hotel room in Melbourne, where tonight we're here for the Australian Institute of Health and Safety Awards, and Josh is a finalist. So we're here today to support Josh in his journey of being recognised. Whether at the end of the day, win or lose makes no difference, because he is a finalist, and that's the big part that matters in these types of situations.
Look, Mitchell Services just like the opportunity to share, you know, the HOP journey, the 4Ds implementation, and our critical risk implementation with the wider industry, and just to be recognised as a final, we're quite humbled. So it's awesome.
That's super cool.
Well done.
Congratulations, Josh.
Yeah, thanks, man.
So guys, what's been happening out in the 4Ds world?
One thing we've been doing recently with a large construction project was they were looking to do something, an improvement on their typical culture survey and their typical yearly conversations around that. And so we did a series of 4D discussions and used that information to unpack a lot of context, and was able to process that into a report, I think, that I think is far superior to the typical metrics, the metrics they were used to getting. So it's not such a little 4D story or nugget, more of a different application.
So, Diane, from your perspective, putting the 4Ds into a survey tool from a psychosocial risk, what do you think the benefit of doing that would be?
I think that, you know, again, it comes down to context, right? I mean, a quantitative survey tool, you know, traditionally only kind of it gathers data, and I think we say, you know, data with soul becomes more important. And the 4Ds, again, just because of that richness or a different thinking frame, is going to provide a different lens. So, you know, it's different, it's new, and for me it helps provide that soul to that data.
The richness of the data that comes out of that survey, there'd be lots of different methods of analytics and how we can explore the context of those stories, rather than viewing it as a scale of, you know, thriving versus harmful. if we use that in a psychosocial risk component. Because it might, because it should show the context of why certain groups are thriving, and it also should show why other groups aren't thriving as much.
So I had the opportunity to go out in the field this week. I went to a site that I hadn't been to probably since about January 2023, and I purposely went in to use a 4D's sort of frame, I guess, in having my conversations. I was only on site for 2 days, but we've got five drill rigs there. So lots of new people I'd never met before. You know, I don't have a inbuilt trusting relationship with any of these workers, but I was able to just go up to, I think the worker's name was Owen. Owen was using one of our brand new machines that's got a big robotic arm. And I just talked to him, and I went in and said, oh, how does this task get difficult? Like using this robot, like, I mean, it's put into, you know, less than manual labor. And he goes, oh, it's actually quite difficult and different. And I was like, oh, can you talk me through that? And he said, well, you know, although it takes away that manual aspect where, you know, I used to screw in a what's called a hole plug into the pipe and pull it out of the ground, it was a very physical work. What I find with the robotic arm is it's actually quite mentally taxing, because I'm really having to concentrate where this thing is going, where it's working. And that was some, you know, that was some insights that I hadn't actually heard from anyone since we've introduced this new technology. And then I went over and talked to the main operator, who was the driller. And I said, oh, how do you find this, you know, this new technology? Is it really different? And he said, look, I came from one machine, and it, you know, it's quite a methodical way of doing things. And then I've worked underground, and it's a totally different way of having to use this machine. But when I've come back up on surface and use this technology, it operates like more of an underground machine, so it's easier for me to use. So something that the business needs to consider is maybe whoever they're putting on these new machines with these robotic arms is to make sure that they have an understanding of that underground environment, those underground techniques, and it's going to make them pick up easier. And I just thought, look, you know, as a leader, it was my way in. It wasn't transactional. I was there to do critical control verifications as well, but those 4Ds discussions just really unlocked a lot of learning that I was able to pass on to operations.
And it also picked up, as you said, where that worker was sharing about the mental taxing element of that. And I doubt that would have been picked up in a risk assessment or a JSA.
No, definitely not. And it was really something that we thought it was easy to use, because like it's almost like an Xbox controller, just a joystick. But we never thought that, you know, he almost said sometimes he has to lean on sort of one foot so we can see where the robotic arm is. He has to position himself where the driller can see him as well. They were insights I had no idea about, but I wouldn't have got that if I went to that site. And as I said in the last episode, going in and talking to them about their housekeeping and then discussing the task, but with that mindset that I was there to solve it and find something. I wasn't there to find anything. I was there to learn. And the 4Ds actually opened that up.
And how do you think the worker felt from that conversation himself?
Yeah.
What learning he got rather than what learning you got?
Yeah, I think, and he was quite proud that he was able to share that with me, because no leader had actually asked. It was just a different question that he hadn't had before, whereas it was usually, criticism or, you know, commenting on that the site could have been better. He was so used to having those conversations with leaders. But, yeah, he was really pleased that he was able to share that with me, because he knows it'll actually go somewhere.
Curiosity versus criticism.
Yes.
I really like, though, that it was really that mental attribute that came out. That's really cool, because you're right, you would never have got that from any other method.
Yeah, like you said a risk assessment wouldn't have called that out.
No, not at all. That's very cool.
Other ones that I went to another drill rig, talked to the worker was Travis, and his offsider was Matt. And they were being really careful with what they were doing. They were doing the task quite slowly. They were like adding pipe to the machine. And I was like, guys, why does this have to be so difficult? Like, it just seems that, you know, you don't feel in a rhythm. And they were like, well, with this new technology, there's bits of the machine that actually wear faster than others. And it's just part of the design that when the machine is joining onto pipe, it has to take almost the weight or the impact of that pipe being added. So he has to be careful with that. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that to me says that that would be a consumable part. So surely that's something that you can easily change. He goes, no, that's where things get really difficult, because sometimes it's a really hard item to keep in stock, and the lead times are quite long, and we have to actually share between the drill rigs. So I was totally unaware, like, there was a 16-week lead time for parts, and the teams were actually working together to manage the stock that they had on site, to manage the wear rates on their rigs. And that was just a simple 4Ds conversation saying, hey, can you talk me through why that doesn't look right?
Hey, Josh, what I like about that is it transcends safety, and it really goes to talk about operational issues and efficiency and problems that are facing, that those teams are facing, but they're adapting and working it out for themselves. But again, the business might not know that it's such an issue either with the design of the machine.
So Brent, we were able to escalate that to the operations GM.
Yep.
Because he was actually, he knew about the wear rates, but probably not the extent, and not knowing about the consumables as well. So he was actually able to like action that.
Yep.
And you know, this is me as the GM of safety going out. And yeah, they're operational conversations, they're work conversations, they're work design conversations. And I have such a bigger impact doing that than some sort of checklist or inspection or, you know, following up my process. I added so much more value to the organization just by uncovering that learning.
But what I love about it is that it's instigated from a safety perspective, but if having a positive effect on the operation as a whole, so it becomes a much more holistic way of getting information and learning from everybody in the organization and affecting all the different departments, but without the interceding, oh, you know, you can't tell me that, I'm in charge of operations. You know, you've got a really interesting dynamic there that's letting people work across those and let that information just flow to a positive effect for the business.
Yeah.
And I think what I was picking up on that is that conversation, the worker was able to critically appraise how they were functioning within the system, rather than normally how the system is being imposed on them.
Yep.
So from what I could see from that, that worker had moved from that normal assessment or evaluative thing, which is what safety would have done to him, but he was able to see how he was existing within that system, and he was able to see the broader issues at play. So to me, that we're starting to see that real critical thinking going on, and in that dynamic nature of work, that's an amazing skill that's being developed.
Yep.
Really good examples that do blur the lines of what was conventionally the safety conversation and that whole collective performance conversation. And interesting how Robbo, your thoughts that things like that wouldn't be put up, caught on a risk assessment, and how people participating in those sorts of conventional safety tools, I mean, are bound by them, limited by them, and kind of give us back what we want to hear, or are limited by the scope of that.
Yeah.
So these are, you know, better in that way. And great examples too of how people are the problem solvers and people are really the solution, and, not, seeing them as a problem to be controlled, but really going and being sensitive to their perspective on the world. Those are great examples, Josh.
And you think they would have reported the wear rates if it had been a traditional mechanism?
Yeah, they would have probably discussed it at a pre-shift meeting, something like that. But, you know, that stays local and that stays at that group, and they don't know if the supervisor escalates it. Whereas just a general manager being curious, one of the key HOP principles is learning is vital.
Yep.
And a leader going out there with that mindset, not trying to catch people out, not trying to, check the system. It's actually being quite genuine and trying to learn.
Yeah, context drives behavior.
Yep.
And I think if we think about what you're saying, Jeff, is that that shifted from being an item on a pre-start to being a learning that went not just local, but that learning went level up. And then that learning is now going to be pushed across the organization as well. So excellent outcome.
And I wonder without you know, somebody initiating that conversation, that the volume of issues like that that the guys experience, I wonder if it just feels like whinging and to bring it up and raise issues every little rub point when it's not asked for. Do you think, Josh, you know the guys?
That's I don't really like that point, to be honest. Yeah, I guess for them it wasn't whinging, because I was quite genuine in the question I was asking. Why is this difficult? Talk me through it.
But I think what it does, the 4Ds are doing here, is letting it move through the organization unimpeded. Because I can imagine that, you know, in a construction scenario, you're having that pre-start and they're going, oh, you know, this thing's always wearing out. And they go, oh, yeah, nah, it's the crap they always buy. It's always wearing out. Right. And that's where it stops, where what this has done is let it transcend that. And it's now moving up and percolating up to the top. And they're going, well, how often do they wear out? Oh, really? We're waiting 16, you know, all those little bits of information that would typically stop much further down the chain and are now percolating to the top to go, well, you know, we can actually fix this and make it better. And that's what we're seeing with the 4Ds. And, you know, in the construction space, I see it all the time where they're just little things like we've sent the wrong nuts. And typically we wouldn't fix that, right? We wouldn't even know about it. They'll just go to the local store and get new fasteners. But what we've found is it went all the way back to our 3D models that had the wrong information on it. We've been sending the wrong nuts to sites around the world continually now for about 6 months, you know, and it just automatically happens because people get to site and don't do anything about it. But with the 4Ds, we actually found out about it. You go, what are we doing? That's just crazy. And I love that because it doesn't become whinging anymore. It becomes, oh, wow, really? Oh, okay. Well, that's such a simple fix.
I love how, Josh, you brought up that, you know, the learning is vital, HOP principle. And, you know, these are different conversations which allows that pause and reflect and that learning time. So it takes those almost throwaway comments that people wouldn't have paid attention to before and gone, let's pause and reflect on that. You know, a lot of the times with the 4D conversations, because it's a group, people tend to go, in my experience, people tend to have gone, yes, we knew that, but it was a bit like an elephant and it didn't, you know, we didn't know what to do with that information or how to have a deeper conversation. Whereas with the 4Ds, I think it allows that learning space to happen in a context which is different from the usual way we've approached things. So that learning is vital. Establishing operational excellence operational learning is really key, I think. You know, you touched on that as well, Brent, where you said, you know, it's not just about safety. And, you know, one of the outputs or learnings from the maritime project that we reflected on was it's a great way to understand capacity on an everyday level, not just from safety, but from quality and from performance as well. And that also helps with people understanding that change from safety as absence of incidents and injuries to safety as a capacity or just any capacity.
Yeah.
I love that, Diane. The better feedback loops, right? With a smidgen of curiosity and a little bit of a thinking frame. You know, leaders can go out and establish much, much better operational feedback loops. And that's so important these days because we know that the data that they've been getting has just led them to, you know, make decisions that either unaware of or reduce capacity, right? The way that these conversations help a leader enhance performance capacity is quite mind-blowing. Yeah. Mm.
And when you said that, like a leader was unaware of, and I think that's key for me. They're just, people are unaware of it. And, you know, we always say, look for the weak signals and the elusive obvious. And this is that ability to pause and think differently, to question, well, I didn't know that. And what is the unintended consequence, or what are the consequences, or what's happening? How have things come together strangely and in unforeseen ways?
It was good. I got a challenge this morning from a gentleman, Pat Wigley, and he said, look, the 4Ds seem to, you know, reveal all these rubs, all these operational issues, but it all seems to be the negative, like, you know, this isn't working, this is a rub. I think the example I've given where, you know, the driller said to me, look, if people work on the underground drill rigs first and then move to this new rig, they actually pick it up quicker. That to me is a positive. That's something I can proactively work on. That's not fixing anything. That's me actually building capacity in the organization, because I can go, oh, people will actually learn this machine quicker by doing this first. We had no idea about that.
I don't see that it being negative as a problem. I think it being negative lets you understand what those people at the front line are having to deal with. And if they see that the organization is taking that on board, then it goes to those results that you're getting, that this is a good place to work. And I heard what Pat said, and I sort of get what he's saying, but you know, in this current context of employment, where it's really hard to find and retain people, if they feel that they're engaged and participating in the improvement of the business, oh, that's such a cool thing to have happen in your organization, right? And that it's come from a, you know, this is a problem or that's a problem, that's fine. At least, you know, how many people would you go, I left the organization because I kept telling them about this thing and they never fixed it and I just got so frustrated and left. Much cooler to them to come to you and then close the loop. The business closes the loop, or the organization closes the loop. What a great organization to work for. And that's what you guys are experiencing, right?
Yep. I reflect with me that the basically the post-employee interview, when the employee's leaving, he was sharing with me, that's when they've been finding out about these weak signals. And he's saying to me, it's too late.
Yep.
Why are we letting it get to this point? And he initially started in that context, why couldn't they have told me earlier? And it sort of leads me back, Josh, that if you had have asked that worker what goes well, what doesn't go well with your job, that person would have had to have, you know, he was focused on judgment rather than curiosity, which is what we're really trying to explore. And when I talk to CEO about that, he goes, you're right, we've got this the wrong way round. We should be having the courage to have these conversations, understand that these things that people are sharing with us, rubs or frictions, whatever they are, those are the things that people are valuing at the moment. Because the great resignation debate is exactly that. You know, it's easy to move on and find another role.
The more time I spend on this, the more I think that these sorts of discussions are a critical step, because they give people an experience with a humble form of inquiry, and they give people a lived experience with sort of practicing some of the principles and understanding what building capacity means. So those ideas are not massive anymore once they've had this experience. And then it segues beautifully into what Eric has always wanted us to do in the Safety 2 space is to, you know, build a compendium of why work goes well. I think that we have to move towards going out and socializing a conversation around you know, on reflection of what was it, what was an advantage in our work today, what did we capitalize on, what accelerated us, what did we learn that we need to be aware of, and where did we adapt, where did we successfully adapt and bring it in. I think with a conversation, well, those are A words, right? Not D words, but I think a conversation around those A words is really going to move us towards what Eric really had in mind for the Safety 2 space, which is pay this exactly this kind of attention to our operation and those folks that really know the work and communicate them with them this way. But specifically, I think he would prefer we had a conversation about why it went well and what needs to be enhanced, not resolved or improved.
I'd see me challenge that. And maybe you can chip in there, Diane, about the things that we've been learning, particularly around psychosocial risks, about how the 4D is allowing us to see those conditions that allow us to actually create change in work design. Because the work design then creates the environment for success.
So, yeah, so we've been working with one particular company looking more at psychosocial risk factors. And we've used 4Ds plus a more appreciative inquiry approach around what does a good day look like and understanding the protective factors that are powerful and that people really see as valuable and, you know, what's important to them and what they cannot lose in their work. And so, you know, you can see where potentially you've got some of those rubs, but also how those elements of the protective factors and the things that really get them through can't be lost. So when you're thinking around, you know, as a CEO or a leadership team, how can you influence where is your locus of control? How can you play to those strengths, understanding, you know, some of those rubs can't be removed. They are what they are, but those strengths can be fortified, essentially. I think again, it's how you can adapt the tools to take some of that thinking and where that organization is at with their thinking as well. Again, I think we're only on a very start of the journey and the 4Ds is one tool. So, you know, looking at where you can apply that in a different context and setting, where you are with the different principles, the conversations you have, you know, you can absolutely start introducing other appreciative inquiry and, you know, looking at what goes right and how you can help make things go right. But you're right, Jeff, I think where we're at the moment, it's easier from a transition perspective to be in this space to create, for me, the awareness of what's happening when nothing's happening and the ability to lean into the everyday work, because it is so easy to kind of go, well, what should we be looking at?
And perhaps if you haven't ever demonstrated anything else, you know, if you come out and seek to have a progressive form of inquiry, they're going to just look at you like they can't trust you.
Yeah. And, you know, the challenging, let's not look at the deficit approach. Let's look at the positives. It doesn't come naturally, unfortunately. And, you know, I think in the session that we ran this morning, I said, well, sometimes, you know, the learning teams and especially everyday mode of a learning team can help you see some of the psychosocial influences or factors that says your work isn't so optimal or actually it's so amazing. And if we can tap more into that amazing space, then I think that's easier actually than trying to solve all of the not so amazing things.
The dynamic of any profit-driven organization is to improve, right? So people are going to really struggle when you say to them, learn what's going well every day. Well, we just know we want to keep on improving. So let's find the things that are going, we can improve. Because if it's going well every day, we can't improve it. Therefore, we don't have operational excellence, you know. And so because it is that iterative process of getting better and better, you know. So I think that's where the, you know, we're going to have to do some more exploration around that to try and understand what that actually looks like. Because at the moment, it's holy grail, really, isn't it, in some respects?
So I had another good challenge this week where my hop beliefs were challenged. So that was pretty cool. There's one quote that has always stuck with me. It's from Andrea Barker, and it was, human and organizational performance is not the absence of rules or discipline. It's the notion that if you depend on a person doing something 100% right, 100% of the time, a lot, that you will be disappointed. So I've got one to share in that we found a machine didn't have a guard in place. And the guard protects a worker from some foot clamps where they could have a crush injury. And we actually had a severe crush injury to a gentleman called Sebastian in October in 2022. So, you know, we're quite, I guess, our spider senses tingle every time we hear the word guard. But before we leapt in and, you know, said, what are these people doing without this guard? We actually applied the 4 D's to it. And we're like, well, does this guard actually make work more difficult? Is it difficult for us to use this guard? And then we asked the question, well, is this piece of equipment different to the other bits of equipment that require the same guard? So we're asking that different question. Does it make work more difficult or dangerous by putting it there? Do you have to do things a different way? And we basically went through these, looking at this control, like, really, we've got a performance standard for this control. We do critical risk verifications on it, but really stepping back and applying the 4 D's to the control itself. And at the end of the day, it ticked all the boxes and it should have been in place. And it was the choice of the individual not to put that guard in place. But the organization then took another step back and said, well, how come they can move the guard? So the CEO, first question, how come they even have the choice to move that guard? Why does it need to be moved? Why can't we just weld it in place? Why can't we bolt it in place? Why can't we secure it in place so that only maintenance have a special key that could undo it? Why don't we have an interlock that, you know, when that guard's not in place, that the machine doesn't work? So we didn't just stop at the individual action. We actually stepped back as an organization and started to ask those deeper questions. We had another one also where we have laser barricades to protect areas of our equipment so that if anyone walks through, the equipment will actually shut down. And we found that one of these lasers had been bypassed. So a laser works on shooting a beam that's got a reflector, and the reflector shoots back and that closes your circuit. And what we found is that a reflector had been taped directly in front of the laser, and therefore the laser was bypassed. So the machine could still be operated, but, you know, the laser was basically pointing at itself a couple of centimeters and it was sticky taped in place. So rather than initially jumping up and down and blaming the worker, we needed to understand, well, why did they need to do that? How were they able to do that? So is that reflector easy to move? And what we actually found is they were able to access a spare reflector and put that in place in the laser and tape it there. And we were like, what? Why are there spare reflectors around? Oh, because the reflectors actually get damaged all the time because of where they're placed on the operating equipment, and they break. So we need a spare so that we can replace them easily. So we looked at making that control better, and was the laser more or less effective than maybe a hard guard with an interlock, which is what we did replace it with. But my point of my story was that we didn't just go, hey, this person's bypassed a safety system. We queried the safety system. Does it make sense for the worker to use this? You know, I can go, look, has the person made an error? Error is normal. Blame's not going to fix anything. But the thing is, that laser and those reflectors aren't only on that piece of equipment. They're on all our equipment. So this is something that the organization can change everywhere.
I think what you're saying, if that had been what I'd call an atypical, that once they'd blamed the worker, they would then have removed all those spare reflectors off the site. Rather than asking the question, is that level of safeguard enough?
Yes.
So I think, once again, you know, shoot off to you, because you actually asked that question. So here we have, we're holding a worker to account and being responsible for their actions. That's fine. That's nothing wrong with doing that. But more importantly, you've also found the weakness in the system. Because ultimately, if I think about it, that error trap was waiting to happen.
Yep.
It's waiting to happen. Because obviously he was able to be more effective and efficient by doing the way that he did it.
Yeah. And look, we work with many, many clients, but what I really liked in this case is that the client actually asked deeper questions and said, well, why did the person feel that they needed to do this? Were they working alone? Did anyone else see them bypass this system? Is this work as normal? Where we imagine that these reflectors are just in place and the laser barricades are in place everywhere. You know, what drove his need to do that, or that worker's need to bypass the system? What were the conditions that led to him needing to bypass it? So for me, looking at those two examples, we talk in the book also about critical steps and critical controls. So the critical control being it'll actually prevent a fatal risk or mitigate the consequences, whereas a critical step is a human action. So we find with the guard, that's a critical control, right? But the critical step is that they need to put that in place. So what are we doing to verify that that's the way it is? So, the organization's looking at that and going, well, it's not actually, that guard isn't a critical control if it can be moved. So we need to find a better way to implement that control and remove that hazard.
Yeah. I think in the book, we explore the difference between a hard control and a soft control. So the guard with the interlock would have been a hard control because it would not have allowed human error to have overcome its level of protection, but because it was effectively a laser or a light curtain device that is relying on the human component. So when we talk about soft control, we're saying that it allowed that workers, imagine workers done, allowed that blue line to move down towards the hazard.
Yep.
I like how you guys talked about it before. You talk about it's a critical control or a critical step. And so once the human has to interact with it or make a decision, it's a critical step.
I wanted to jump in with that and say, Josh, we love the Mitchell stories. And I think, your efforts, of course, but I think the wonderful thing about the Mitchell stories is the Mitchell people. And every story I've heard has this human element from the field. Boy, do you ever hire humans, such humans. You probably hire the humanest humans in all the drilling industry. That, going back to how you started that conversation, Josh, we know that workers are going to be the problem solvers. They just are. And they're not going to be the whingers, if they're not really humbly asked for their perspective. They're going to soldier on and they're going to be the problem solvers. But we don't want them solving the problems that we create with sloppy, messy controls, and that's really a story of that is using some kind of Mission Impossible Tom Cruise kind of mirror laser play to get his work done, as opposed to being able to say this is stupid. So that's really what we're moving towards, and I think it's a great story. Your stories are always top notch.
Yeah, there was a challenge from Christian Young recently at a large mining conference in Australia. There was like 1200 people in attendance, and he just said there's not enough sharing of stories or lessons learned. So I know that my boss Andrew doesn't mind me sharing these stories, because this is happening everywhere, right? And if we're a finalist for a national award for safety, yet we've still got this stuff going on every single day. We had another one recently where one of our workers was exposed to a fall from height. So they were basically climbing up on a drill rig, and then they were exposed to a falling from height risk. And rather than going, oh, what a bad person climbing up there and being exposed at working height, we asked that question: why did he have to climb up there? What allowed them to climb up there? What was the task they were trying to do? And what we actually found is that some hoses had been tangled up in the mast of the drill rig. And we're like, okay, well, why'd that happen? And what we found is that we'd removed a part of the equipment on the drill rig, but part of the process of removing that they leave some hoses in place and they bundle that up, and so that it's out of the way. And what happened is that that group of hoses became unbundled, and so other hoses on the drill rigs wrapped in that. So that created a working at heights task. that didn't exist, wasn't planned for, isn't in the risk assessment because we didn't know it would happen, but the person got exposed to that risk. So the initial focus was on, oh, that person's exposed to a working at heights risk, what a bad person.